Welcome to Plain Talk. Plain Talk has a new podcast every 2 weeks with up-to-date information about aviation technologies for general and business aviation. From home to cockpit to boardroom to personal tech, Plain Talk provides informative information for pilots, industry insiders, and aviation enthusiasts alike. My name is Phil Lightstone. I'm a general aviation pilot with over 1,900 hours in my logbook, flying almost every week with over 30 years' experience in the technology and aviation industries. Well, I'd like to welcome a very special guest to the Plain Talk cockpit, Sean Nielsen, CEO of a company I'm sure you've all heard of, Cirrus Aircraft, who manufacture very, very cool airplanes. Welcome, Sean.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I spent some time looking at your bio. It's very impressive, to say the least, and you're working for just a wonderful aerospace company.
Thank you.
And I was just curious, what attracted you to join Cirrus in 2019?
Many things. You know, so I grew up in a small town in Denmark, and our farm bordered a small airport. And so every morning I would go running. I played competitive soccer, so I would try to stay in shape, and I would go run every morning and or evening. And on that small airport, it would be gliders, 172s, Cessnas, and so forth. And I was just sort of smitten by it, to see these things take off and land all the time. And when I was nine, I was fortunate enough to go have my first flight. So every year they would sort of have an appreciation for all their neighbors that was sort of, had to deal with the noise and so forth. And I elected to go fly in a glider.
Wow.
So that was my first actual flight.
Nine years old.
Yeah, but I didn't handle the controls, but I sat in the back. And it was one of those where they pull you up on the ground and you literally just vertically, almost shoot up. And I was just taken by it. So I've always had a fascination for flying and being in that world, but never had the opportunity to get into it.
Sure.
The big company, to work for in Denmark at the time was Bang & Olufsen and Lego and some of those iconic companies. And so I went into, got my apprenticeship at Bang & Olufsen, and it sort of just took me the next 17 years, to get to the U.S. And I ran the North American and South American operation as president for 7 years before I joined Tesla.
Wow, so quite a technology career.
Yeah, I mean, it's always been about producing something that has value, right? Rather than you hear so much today about people making fortunes on Bitcoin and speculations on stock and real estate, and I've always sort of grown up in a culture where you have to build something. You should build something that has long lasting value or make somebody's life better or enrich them in some capacity. And music was the thing for Bang & Olufsen. Electric cars was sort of a big change in an industry for the cars, right? And airplanes bring people together.
Well, they sure do.
It connects the world.
So, with coming over to Cirrus in 2019, have you transplanted any of that DNA from Bang & Olufsen and Tesla?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of similarities. I mean, both companies, it's very much around design, but with a purpose, right? It has to be high quality, high craftsmanship. Safety is pinnacle to all of it, right? You can't have a television, catching fire or a car, crashing. And obviously the same applies to airplanes. It starts with safety in mind.
Well, of course. Safety is paramount in the aviation game. It's not like we can kind of get out and pull over.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. So there's just a lot of parallels from the sort of the lifestyle aspect of it, the building something that's hard to, to build and manufacture, to the full ecosystem of once you have sold the airplane, it really needs a home to come out into, so it's not an orphan out in the world in that sense, which means that you have to build the service network, the parts distribution, the AOG support, the aftermarket upgrades, all the things that sort of
training
that come with the airplane in ownership, which all it starts actually all a few steps before that, which is learning how to fly, right? And I don't know if you know this, but about 90% of people that start their private pilot license never finish it. Eventually, you're going to run out of customers to sell to, right, if you can't create a bigger pie. So we really spend a lot of energy on how do you make it easier to fly, and how do you make it easier to learn how to fly, and how do you make it easier to own and operate an aircraft, right? If you can make all those things easier, then more people are going to come into aviation, which is really what it's all about.
Easier and safer.
Yep.
I can attest, I have a friend of mine owned an SR-22.
Okay.
High IFR, he had a bit of a challenge. 800 feet AGL, he pulled the parachute, saved his life, his wife's life.
Good.
The under parachute, landed on the ground. No injuries other than sadly, the airplane hit a fence.
Yeah, okay.
Fence. These things.
Well, the airplane becomes sort of the shock absorption, but it's a fantastic safety feature that our founders at the time, the Club Myers, decided to put in. Right, and it comes with a lot of trade-offs. Like you could have put in a couple hundred pounds of fuel or an extra passenger, but they decided that was so important. In this journey of changing aviation.
I mean, the journey that your founders have taken, it's absolutely phenomenal.
Yep.
They've done things that just other folks haven't done.
Yep.
It's absolutely amazing. With that said, I'm a little curious about the electrification of certified aircraft. And are we going to see like an ESR-22 or an E-TRAC anytime soon on the horizon?
Not anytime soon.
I mean, promise I won't tell anyone.
Yeah, right. It's just going to be between me and you. Not anytime soon. So why is that? Well, first of all, the power density is just not there yet. And so the technology in batteries is just not there yet. Obviously, it's super heavy. I think sort of average flight time is 20, 30 minutes with no reserves, some of the other players in the industry have been able to get out of it, which doesn't really you can't even do a flight training lesson with that, right? And our customers, the missions that they use the airplane for, it's 500, 600, 700, 800 mile, flights. So what we need to do, the missions that our customers are trying to fulfill, simply right now cannot be done with electric. So that's one. Number two is the cycles, that a battery can handle, right? Let's just make up a number for argument's sake. Let's say it's 1,000 cycles, and cycles, let's call them 20, 30 minutes. You divide that up into 1,000. It's really
expensive.
It's very expensive. You would have to replace the battery in an unusual amount of time. So it's just not economic. Right now, right, and the mission you can fulfill is not right.
What do you think about the future of hydrogen?
I think it's challenging for a lot of reasons. You have to have, again, and it is with any sort of alternative fuel, right? Because having gone through this at Tesla, we spend billions of dollars building out the charging infrastructure, right?
Of course.
And that's very predictable. It's you put it next to highways where cars are coming and so forth. But let's say an airplane was hydrogen or battery driven. If you have to deviate to another airport because of weather or whatnot, and there's no fuel there, like there's no hydrogen system there or whatever, it becomes very expensive to build up that infrastructure. And until the industry and the governments, not just the U.S. but EASA and all the other international setups, agree on a standard, it's very difficult for the OEMs to take a bet and risk on one technology over the other. I think the next step that the industry will go through is to remove lead from the fuel. Right, there's a big initiative with Eagle and Gamma and the FAA going on right now to come up with a plan where we collectively can invent a new fuel type that's a drop-in replacement, to the leaded 100 octane that we use now. And then, somebody has to invent it, somebody has to refine it and distribute it, and then all the engines have to be recertified to use it and so forth. So there's a lot of work ahead of us. But I think that's the first hurdle. Like, let's get lead out of the fuel, and then figure out how do we go to the next green step on the journey.
I've been following fungible fuel plants. There's a few beta fuel plants in Canada with the idea of taking carbon emissions out of the air, applying green energy to it, and manufacturing any kind of fuel you want, hopefully unleaded 100 UL, for lack of a better word. And then I see a nirvana of little micro plants at every airport, getting rid of the complete supply chain.
Yeah, and I if I had a crystal ball, you know, we would make a bet. But right now, so I think like the VTOL industry, the vertical takeoff and landing, obviously are making a bet on electric. I think the big commercial, you know, players are making several bets, right? And hydrogen is one of them. But they also have very predictable point to point, right? There's a big airport where they control the fuel, and they can be more adventurous, so to speak, with those technologies. So I think they will mature and narrow the choices. And then once that has been ironed out, the smaller players in the industry like us, even though we're not that small anymore, but we can make a more predictable bet.
So it's really an evolution rather than a jump start overnight.
Yeah.
So what's the biggest change that you see at Cirrus?
It's interesting because when you're in it, you're making lots of small changes, right? So for you, it doesn't feel like, you know, big changes, but for somebody looking in from the outside, it probably seems like big leaps, you know, forward. But, you know, 3 years ago, we were 2.5 locations, let's call it that. You know, we were Grand Forks and Duluth was in place, and we're building out Knoxville. Well, today we've got 6, 7, 8 locations almost. You know, we've added McKinney in Dallas with a factory direct service and flight. We have an R&D facility in McKinney also. We've added flight training and repair in Kissimmee, Florida. We have an R&D facility in Phoenix, and we also have a flight training operation in Phoenix now. We've acquired a small paint facility in Benton Harbor. Previously called Flying Colors. So we're just expanding quite a bit over the last 3 years. In fact, we're spending almost 10 times as much in what's called CapEx and intangibles compared to what we were spending in 2018 pre-pandemic.
Wow. That's a huge jump.
Huge jump, right? And that also goes into the evolution of product. Obviously, we launched last year the G2 Plus for the Vision Jet, you know, adding on Wi-Fi and hot and high, so you can get out of, shorter runways at high and hot conditions. So we're constantly doing what I call base hits. They don't all have to be home runs, right? Like, but lots of base hits get you around the plates, you know, and scoring, you know, just as efficiently sometimes. So we're doing a lot of things like that just a higher pace of innovation. But sometimes smaller bites. Yeah.
So Cirrus's foundations has always been about innovation, quality, and safety.
Yeah.
Any new safety features on the horizon?
Yes, in the sense that so Cirrus IQ, which is this box we put on the SR series in 2020, essentially is this little sort of black box, if you will, that you can turn on remotely and wake up the plane and see your fuel and your oxygen level and, you know, how much TKI fluid or TKS fluid you've got on. And so it's helping you, you know, pre-flight, if you will. But at the same time, when you touch down, all the data from that flight is ported over to a data warehouse. So we can, with the pilot's permission, help them with training, with insurance, with a whole and preventative maintenance and a bunch of other safety-related features. So a good example is when you touch down, it's weight on wheels, all this data is offloaded, and we immediately can see how much of the runway did the pilot chew up before they touched down. Are they landing on the center line or 5 feet left of the center line? What's the approach speed and the angle of attack, you know, as per the training manual? And if it's not, we can essentially send you a scorecard and say, hey, this is how you did, right? you instead of 3%, you know, angle of attack, you came in at 5, and you were like 10 knots fast, like, and all these things, and send you essentially a voucher to go train with your local CSIP and say, hey, you know, you have these sort of areas of improvement. The first hour is on us, you know, go train, right? To make them a safer pilot, right? So, and so that's one element of like safety features, like that the box is already on board. Now we got to utilize the data for something meaningful, right?
So are you looking at, I mean, as you described that that connected ecosystem, data flowing into your back end, are you doing any artificial intelligence on that data? And then moving to the next step with real-time satellite communications, cellular from our friends at Gogo Flight as an example, doing in-cockpit predictive real-time, you know, essentially a virtual flight instructor.
The possibilities in the future are sort of endless, right? It starts with getting the aircraft connected. You know, so right now we've got the aircraft on the SR, you know, connected with Sirius IQ. And on the jet, we have Wi-Fi, but no Sirius IQ on it yet. In the future, obviously, we're going to try and find a way to connect the aircraft, right, sort of in flight. And then once you have that, you have, you know, those sort of capabilities. But that's still, you know, still far out in the future. The first thing we got to do is begin to learn, right? So now the data is coming off the SR. Now we got to figure out how do we turn that data into useful content for you, the owner. We will get some useful content in terms of warranty and, you know, preventative maintenance and predictive maintenance, but it's really about like how can we turn that into benefits to you as an owner.
Well, no doubt the Nirvana is, you know, digital cockpit, connected cockpit, cloud, artificial intelligence, and predictive, reactive.
Analytics. So safe return on the jet, right, is an example of essentially an autonomous airplane, right? I mean, once you push that button, the plane is making decisions on its own without being connected to the ground, right? And so in many ways, the technology is already there. We now need other functions, you know, like the FAA and so forth to educate themselves so they can allow it to be used for non-emergency procedures, right? You can imagine a scenario in the future where, let's say, it's not an emergency, but there's a lot of crosswind, and you just need a little help, right? And you might need some landing assist, right? Without it declaring an emergency, you might want to push a button that gives you some help.
That, like, virtual, right? Instructor.
So we're not there yet, but getting these technologies in place, right, allows us to take the next step in that journey.
So I think, I think you said something quite interesting, which is that technically the technology is there.
Yeah.
It's about, you know, your role as an evangelist to the regulators, both the FAA and Transport and EASA, to help them with the journey to certification.
Yeah, there's certainly a part of that, and that's a partnership, right? And we all work with the FAA, trying to bring more people into aviation, make safer airplanes, and so forth. I'm sure that the VTOL industry will help a lot in that, you know, direction, because they're certainly pushing on the technology side and less so the actual, you know, aircraft side. But I think as an industry, we're all moving in that direction of how do we bring more people into aviation.
So the appetite of business aviation for jets just seems to be unstoppable. Is there a larger vision jet, i.e. maybe a Mark II, on the drawing board? And I promise I won't tell anyone.
No, not right now. I mean, we have a backlog of more than 400 Vision jets right now. So essentially, everything we can produce the next 3 to 4 years is already on order. So what we're focused on is continuing to innovate on that platform, bring more features and benefits out to both the existing, you know, owners, and whenever possible, retrofit them. Like, so, you know, the hot and high feature. And Wi-Fi is, you know, retrofittable features. So we're trying to make sure that we take good care of the customers that own the airplanes now, but and take care of the customers that are waiting on taking delivery, right? So will there one day be, you know, more airplanes in the portfolio? Sure. I mean, that's you can't grow unless you add product, you know, over time. But whether or not that's a different platform or, you know, a different jet, it's time will tell.
So as the CEO, how do you manage the culture of change R&D under a backdrop of a regulator who traditionally might not go as fast as you would like them to go?
Yeah, I mean, we have to remember why they are not wanting to go as fast as we would like them to. It's always with safety in mind, right? And safety is not for sale. And it's good that, you know, the FAA sometimes, you know, says, hey, you know, let's make sure it works and, like, just, you know, cross the T's and dot the I's. So they're there actually to help, right? They're not there to prevent you. So it's all about creating a good relationship to the FAA, educating them. Because obviously we're the expert in our platform. It's impossible for the FAA to be experts in every single platform that is served up to them, right? So I really consider it an industry partnership, right? And yes, you know, the industry wants to go faster than the FAA, but you know, that's evolution. Just because sometimes you can doesn't mean you should do something, right? And if we always start out with safety safety as the core driver of everything we do, and then figure out, okay, you know, why do we want to do it? Right? A lot of the VTOL, you know, the vertical takeoff and landing, I don't fully understand the use case. Like, as an example, if all you can fly right now is 20 to 30 minutes, and all you can do is hop from, I don't know, Walnut Creek to San Francisco airport, right? And you still have to go to a helipad, you know, in Walnut Creek to fly over to a helipad, you know, outside San Francisco airport, because obviously they're not going to let you zip in the middle of airline traffic, you know, coming down. What's the benefit? Like, you would have to drive to the helipad, park, wait for your flight, fly over, and my assumption is that these helipads can't be that big, right? So you have to wait your turn. So now you're hovering there, running out of juice, and then you have to land and then get in some sort of vehicle to get to the airport. I just don't understand the use case just now, right?
I live in Toronto.
Yeah.
And, you know, my commute was maybe 20 kilometers. Yeah. And based upon a very old, archaic highway system,
yep,
in traffic that's continually growing, yep, it could be an hour to an hour and a half.
Yeah.
Yet in an eVTOL, that could perhaps be 10 minutes.
If you can land where you want to land.
And I think that's right. Back to the developers who own shopping centers, who are repurposing and creating urban air mobility hubs. Yeah. Let's think of them as big train stations.
Yep.
The train stations from the steam.
Yeah, there's no doubt that eventually it'll be all be worked out, right? There's going to be, you know, helipads or landing spots and so forth, but I just don't think we're there right now. We still need more autonomous features to be in, you know, to be developed.
Sure.
We still need battery to be, you know, developed. We still need thousands and thousands of charging stations to be available, and everybody has to agree on a format so that when you know, just like Tesla, right, you can't, in a BMW, pull up and use a Tesla charging station, right? So there's so many things that has to be organized before vertical takeoff and landing can really be as give you the freedom you're talking about. It's still very much point to point. So I think what will happen first is things like freight or package delivery, mm-hmm, you know, where there's not a person on board, in rural areas where you're not zipping in over the cities. Would definitely, I think, would be first. Then medical transportation, because it's an emergency, maybe organ donors and things like that. And so there'll be probably a decade of working out all the logistical problems and the technical issues before people start flying.
And right. There's the next-gen airspace nav systems.
Yep.
There's a lot. I think you're absolutely right. Yep. There's a lot of work to do. Right. I think we can perhaps all see the end game.
Oh, there's no doubt that it's coming. There's no doubt that it's coming, right? But in terms of what we need to focus on right now as Cirrus, our focus is in sort of the 5 to 10 year, you know, horizon. Right?
Yeah. So, Sean, if there was just one thing that you could change today, what would that be?
I mean, we're pretty happy with how things are going. We've added 400 people to the company last year, and we're planning to add another 400 people this year. So we're trying to balance scaling and, you know, reducing the backlog, because the backlog is too large right now. I mean, that sounds weird to say that, but it's 2.5 year wait for a propeller airplane, and, you know, north of 2 to 3 years for the jet. So we'd like that to be shorter. So we need to scale manufacturing. So we need more people to be part of that journey. But we also need to scale the services around, so these airplanes come out into a world where they can be looked after from training perspective, service perspective. So it's really about how to manage that scaling of the business, right? Without risking the business, like by scaling too fast, right? And it's always the right quality, the right safety first, and then we'll scale as fast as we can.
Well, Sean, I really appreciate you coming into the Plane Talk cockpit. Any final words for the audience?
No, I think we talked about a lot today, but yeah, thank you very much for your time and including us.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Plane Talk. If you have any ideas for a future Plane Talk episode, please go to the Contact Us page at planetalk.ca and send in your idea. Don't forget to like us at planetalk.ca, our Facebook and LinkedIn pages, and this podcast. And never stop living the dream.